Exercise L17. Organizing information. 1.
It may be true that no two snowflakes are exactly alike, but they can be classified by their shape, and this is dictated by the way water molecules in the atmosphere react to temperatures. Good snowflake formation needs low temperatures. Okay. So what are the different shapes, and what influences the final shape that a snowflake takes? Now, there are three different types of snowflakes. The most familiar type of these three basic types is the star, which looks like the common picture book illustration of a star with six points. The second type, type 2, is a solid prism shape, a column, like a section cut through a lead pencil. The third type, the plate, looks like a tiny hexagonal dinner plate. Okay, so how do they get those shapes? Well, extreme conditions like those in the polar areas produce the perfect prisms. But there isn't enough precipitation there, in the polar areas, for stars to form. Stars need precipitation in order to form. So you usually don't find stars at the poles. The plates are sort of in between the prisms and stars. Plates need higher temperatures than those found at the poles where the prisms form, but they need less humidity than is needed for the formation of stars. Now, in places where the temperature is too high, or where there's a high wind, snowflakes tend to be irregular. The crystals have not really formed properly, or have become damaged by the weather conditions. That's why we frequently don't see nice formations here, and of course, since we don't live at the poles, we never see prisms.
The speaker talks about the shapes of snowflakes. Match each type below with the conditions under which it develops. Two.
Many folk cures that have been around for centuries may be more therapeutic, more medically useful than previously suspected. Some home remedies have been found to have antiviral properties, and others have antibacterial properties. So, the importance of documenting these remedies and experimenting to see if they really work can't be overemphasized. A case in point is the wormwood plant. This plant has been used for hundreds of years in China and Vietnam to combat malaria. In fact, an early record of wormwood, of the medicinal use of wormwood, was found in a recipe discovered in a Southeast Asian tomb. A tomb dating from 168 BC. So, the properties of the wormwood were closely investigated, and a new anti-malarial drug came out of this study. So its antiviral properties led to the development of a drug for malaria. Because the research found that it was indeed effective against this virus. So its antiviral properties were found to be correct. Another case is sugar. See, in parts of South America, a powder obtained from grinding sugarcane is used for healing infections in wounds. And this usage may date back several hundred years. So, experiments carried out on several hundred patients indicated that ordinary sugar in high concentrations kills off bacteria. Its suction effect helps by eliminating dead cells and creating a glass-like layer, and this glass-like layer protects the wound and ensures its healing. Another antibacterial folk medicine that scientists are investigating is one used by Arab fishermen who rub their wounds with a venomous catfish to quicken healing. This catfish excretes a gel-like slime, and this slime has been found to contain not only antibiotics, but a coagulant that helps close injured blood vessels, anti-inflammatory agents, and a chemical that directs production of a glue-like material that aids healing. Because traditional herbal treatments are often locally available and inexpensive, that makes them ideal for use by local people. Documentation of traditional medicines worldwide needs to be undertaken before those traditions are lost. An analysis of the substances can be made, and synthetic substances can be developed for human use around the world.
The speaker talks about folk cures and what they were used for. Match the folk treatment to the properties it supposedly has. Three.
Today, I want to talk about the development of refrigeration. There is evidence that early humans stored food underwater. Early humans probably noticed that their meat would last longer if it was kept underwater or stored in a cave or was packed in snow. Later, ice was actively harvested from frozen lakes and rivers, and this ice would be stored in specially constructed buildings called ice houses to preserve food until the following winter. Is anyone familiar with these buildings? Yes, Tom.
Well, yeah. In my hometown, there's one that's been made into a museum. I think it was used to store ice, until the 1920s.
Uh-huh. Could you, describe the building for us?
Well, it's a large windowless building, a brick and stone building, and the ice blocks were packed in straw so that the ice wouldn't melt. The straw kept the ice from melting for a while, anyway.
Okay, yeah, that's a good description of an ice house. A later storage container was the ice box. And what would be the advantages of an ice box? An ice box over an ice house? Susan?
Well, as I understand it, the ice box is a kind of early refrigerator. So ice houses served whole communities, whereas ice boxes were small enough to put in your house. So, it was more private and good for house, domestic use. They kind of look like a cupboard, often with legs, and were made of wood.
Uh-huh, that's correct. The inside of the box was lined with tin or zinc, and sawdust was frequently used for insulation purposes. Blocks of ice were delivered to people's homes like morning newspapers. So, when do you think this method of refrigeration began to be obsolete?
Presumably when modern electric refrigerators were introduced. Ice boxes didn't use electricity, did they?
That's right, Tom. That's right. And refrigeration technology didn't stop there. It continues to develop today.
The class discussion is about the development of refrigeration. Match each description with the corresponding form of refrigeration. Four.
In underground cave systems, rainfall containing minerals absorbed from carbonate rock and plant debris builds up formations known as speleothems. Let me spell that for you. S-P-E-L-E-O-T-H-E-M-S. Speleothems. The formations that build up in caves. So over geological time, a variety of fantastically shaped structures can develop within a cave system. I'd like to talk about the different speleothems and how they're formed, usually by one of two types of water conditions, water dripping or water flowing. For some speleothems to develop, mineral-laden water drips through the cave roof. The minerals from the dripping water start to build up vertical, elongated, hollow tubes hanging from the ceiling of the cave. These tubes are known as soda straws. They look like a soda straw, and water drips from them like when you take a straw out of a drink. So drops of water run down the inside of the tube, leaving mineral residues at the opening. Over time, these soda straws can build up to several feet in length, and eventually they become plugged up, so the water can't run through the straw anymore. So it runs down the outside surface. When this happens, this dripping down the outside of the straw, the formation evolves into an icicle-shaped stalactite. Of course, this constant dripping of water off the end of the straw, or the stalactite, hits the floor of the cave under the formation. And this builds up a vertical formation rising from the floor directly underneath the stalactite. And this formation is known as a stalagmite. Stalagmites typically have rounded ends due to the water splashing down from above. But their shapes vary a lot. Sometimes stalactites and stalagmites grow together to form a column from floor to ceiling. Other kinds of formations found in caves, besides soda straws, stalactites, and stalagmites, are those formed by flowing water. Okay? So, sometimes the water flows down the inclined ceiling of a cave, and when this happens, the mineral solution is deposited in thin trails. The deposits build up in a series of ripples and folds, and it looks like a layer of cloth. This kind of speleothem is called a drapery. You can visualize this speleothem as a piece of cloth draped over a ramp of some sort. Okay, now, if the water falls down a vertical surface instead of a slope, the resulting formations take on the appearance of a waterfall, and this is known as flowstone. Now, speleothems are found in a variety of colors as well as shapes. This is due to the impurities, both natural and artificial, that mix with the dripping or flowing water as it seeps underground.
The professor talks about cave formations. Match each cave formation with the corresponding water condition.